From the National Catholic Register, this is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
As the conflict with Iran enters its fourth week, the widening fighting has now impacted multiple countries in the region. One of the most impacted is Lebanon. Register contributor and Middle East expert Ambassador Alberto Fernandez joins us this week on Register Radio. And then, faith and reason are not and cannot be in conflict with each other. Bishop Earl Fernandez of Columbus, Ohio, tells us about efforts to help young people see the importance of that relationship. Hello, I'm Matthew Bunsen, Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News and happily host of Register Radio, joined as always by my co-host, Shannon Mullen, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register. How are you?
Good, Matthew. Good to be with you.
So we have two Fernandezes this week, and we're blessed to have them both. So as I was just mentioning, our guest this week recently wrote in his latest commentary for the Register, the Lebanon sideshow could be worse than the Iranian main event. And the way he puts it is, the situation in Lebanon is the sideshow that could turn out to be more catastrophic than the main event. The terrorist group Hezbollah decided to enter the war against Israel despite the fact that Lebanon's population is war-weary, overwhelmingly opposed to more conflict, and the country was already in deep economic crisis even before Hezbollah plunged the country into the last war in October 2023. We're joined by Ambassador Alberto Fernandez, Register contributor and Middle East expert, as I was saying. Ambassador, welcome back to Register Radio.
Thank you, Matthew. It's a pleasure to be on with you all.
The way this conflict, war, however one wants to define it, is shaping out, I'm getting the increasing feeling that we're probably going to have to book you almost every week. So I will apologize in advance for that.
I hope not. I hope it ends soon, but I'm always happy to help.
So as you note, the Iranian conflict has expanded, certainly by deliberate effort on the part of the Iranians. And here we are talking now about Iraq and also Lebanon, but you seem very much focused on Lebanon.
Yes, I mean, you could say also it also, of course, expanded in the Gulf, in the Arab Gulf states, but that's, of course, an economic weapon as opposed to something else. I mean, the reason I said Lebanon is worse or more catastrophic is, of course, because it's a smaller country, and so the impact on that smaller country is much greater in the aggregate. And unfortunately, we're seeing that in terms of percentage of people that have been displaced, people killed, all of that that's happened.
Yeah, Ambassador, about 1 million people have reportedly been displaced over just the past 10 days in Lebanon. That's an amazing upheaval. Before we get into this current conflict, can you just describe how precarious Lebanon was even before this latest round of fighting began?
Well, of course, Lebanon has been at the mercy of conflict and upheaval for a very long time. Last year was the 50th anniversary since the Lebanese Civil War, and there was plenty of conflict before that war. What happened in recent years, of course, was a deep economic crisis. Lebanon basically had a kind of Ponzi scheme, a financial system, which collapsed in 2019 and plunged the country into deep economic crisis. On top of that, you have Hezbollah, which is like a parasite on the Lebanese political and social system. It's, an army in and of itself loyal to Iran, which follows Iran's dictates. So it plunged the country into war in 2006, almost into war 6 years later, and then most infamously in 2023 and now 2026.
Ambassador, there seems to be this willingness on the part of Hezbollah, and we saw it as well with Hamas, to suffer almost catastrophic losses in its conflict with Israel. As well as they seem quite willing to have massive civilian losses. What is that strategy?
Well, the strategy, first of all, of course, Hezbollah sees itself as an integral part of the Iranian regime. I mean, these are Lebanese or mostly Lebanese Shia Muslims, but they are adherents to the ideology of the Islamic Republic of Iran. As their most famous figure, Hassan Nasrallah, said, "I do not want to see an Islamic Republic of Lebanon. What I want to see is a Lebanon which is a part of an Islamic Republic of Iran under the rule of the hidden imam." So he basically saw Lebanon is part of the Iranian project. And so that's where it comes from. It's an ideological worldview. And of course, Lebanon is, despite the Shia reality of Hezbollah, is a country with many different groups, and is a country that still, despite immigration, is about one-third Christian to this day.
Yeah, and as you write, Ambassador, the area where this latest fighting between Israel and Hezbollah, in between is a concentration of Christian communities who are, you know, most vulnerable here. These are communities that have every reason to leave, it seems, and yet they have remained there, and they're really paying a price for it right now.
Yeah, it's hard to know exactly. I mean, I've been talking to people there, and basically there's somebody in all of the remaining Christian villages of the south. Some people stayed behind, but a lot of people have fled to Beirut just to be out of the crossfire between Hezbollah and Israel. So you have a handful of people or a minority of the population that stayed behind in these Christian villages to kind of try to protect them and to have a Christian presence there along the border. They're obviously completely opposed to the war. They condemn Hezbollah for dragging Lebanon into the war once again, but that's the reality that they face.
And there seems to be little that the Lebanese armed forces can do about this. Would that be fair?
There's a problem in Lebanon, and that is that Hezbollah, people criticize it and say, you know, it's a state within a state, and it's an independent militia, all of which is true. But Hezbollah has a presence in the government. It has ministers in the government. The powerful head of the parliament is, while not Hezbollah, is a Hezbollah ally. And the army is afraid of either fragmenting along sectarian lines, as happened during the Lebanese Civil War. You know, Christian soldiers went with the Christian militias, Muslims went with the Muslims back in 75. To avoid that, and also the fear is, to be frank, that maybe the army couldn't stand up to Hezbollah. I think it could, but obviously that would require conflict.
Mm-hmm. Ambassador, a weakened Iran, even a temporarily weakened Iran, what does that look like in Lebanon? If the outcome of this war is a significantly reduced Iranian threat, what happens in Lebanon, do you think?
Well, there are two things. First of all, of course, it does depend on how many resources Iran has at the end of this war, right? But for Iran, Hezbollah has been an extremely valuable ally. And over the past year, reports say that Iran has funneled at least $1 billion to Lebanon for Hezbollah to rebuild the organization after the battering it took during the previous war with Israel. That's $1 billion. That's a lot of hard currency for an Iran which already last year was suffering all kinds of economic and social problems, you know, Tehran running out of water and all of these issues. So it shows you how important Hezbollah is as a weapon against Israel, a kind of force projector, and they're not going to give that up. But if Iran has a lot less money as a result of the war, certainly that will impact its ability to do mischief widely. The big question now in Lebanon is this, and actually it's a political question that's happening within the leadership of the Lebanese government right now. They want to reach out to Israel. They've said so. But the question is, reach out for what? There are Lebanese who say, we can't keep going through this every few years. Another war, more destruction, more death. We want a peace. Doesn't mean we like the Israelis, but we want a peace. We want to stop this cycle. Then there are the partisans of Hezbollah who say, what you want to get with Israel is not a peace, but a ceasefire, return to the status quo a month ago.
Yeah, Ambassador, let's turn briefly to that main event, as you describe it, in Iran. Where are we with this current situation?
Well, it's, there's the fog of war, right? There's certain things which are clear. First of all, of course, the alliance, the American-Israeli alliance, is militarily dominant, right? Absolutely dominant over Iran. It can basically do whatever it wants over Iran and has been extremely successful militarily. But Iran has successfully used the oil weapon or the economic weapon and has been able to not pressure the United States. They can't hit the United States. They can't hit Israel very well. But they've been able to hit the Gulf states and raise the price of oil worldwide. Not as much as they'd like, as much as the Iranian regime would like, but heading in that direction. It's crazy. You know, oil is much more expensive now in the Far East than it is in the United States. So on the one hand, the U.S. and Israel are dominant militarily, but there's the clock ticking, a kind of economic clock ticking. Whether the war means it has one more week or one more month, I think that's the parameter. We're talking about from between a week to several weeks before various factors cause the war to end, which means it'll probably end with a very weakened, battered Iran with a lot of its military-industrial complex destroyed, but a regime probably still in power.
Well, and as you very sagely noted some weeks ago when this conflict started, for the Iranians and similar regimes, mere survival gives them the opportunity to declare victory. Ambassador, yes. Thank you so much, as always, for your insights and for your commentaries. I know all of us read them with great enthusiasm, but also with great sadness.
Thank you.
Well, you're listening to Register Radio here on EWTN Radio. Next up, we talk with Bishop Earl Fernandez about the relationship between faith and reason. Stay tuned to Register Radio.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
And welcome back to Register Radio. I'm Matthew Bunsen here, as always, with Shannon Mullen, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register. Well, our next guest has written that faith and science are not enemies, and young people need to hear it. If young Catholics believe science and faith are in conflict, the Church must show them why the two belong together. The author of that is Bishop Earl Fernandez, the shepherd of Columbus, Ohio. And Your Excellency, welcome to Register Radio.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's a privilege to talk to you at any time, but especially on a topic that I think needs a great deal of focus by the Church today, given the importance of that relationship of faith and reason.
Well, that's correct. And so the USCCB is really focused over the in its strategic plan on disaffiliation. Sometimes we hear about a religious disaffiliation, the so-called rise of the nuns, that young people aren't practicing, and they're not. It's not just that they're falling. Catholics are falling into Protestantism. They're falling into disbelief, no religious affiliation whatsoever. It's presupposed that one of the reasons is that young people don't see the compatibility between faith and reason, faith and science, or that somehow or the other the hard sciences disprove faith, and so. The USCCB Committee on Doctrine wanted to engage the question, and we did so in partnership with the Society of Catholic Scientists and the McGrath Institute at Notre Dame. The McGrath Institute has always been a great partner for us, and so we wanted to examine this question in depth. And so bishops were invited, as well as members, Catholic educators, because somehow or the other we have to get this to young people and integrate it in the curriculum or into our pedagogical methods to show how faith and science are compatible. And some years ago, maybe 10 years ago, the Templeton Foundation had offered a grant to seminaries and scientists because Catholics had been at the forefront for a long time in the hard sciences. So you could think of someone, a historical figure like Gregor Mendel, who was an Augustinian monk, who's the father of modern genetics. You could think of Georges Lemaître, who is a Catholic priest who came up with what's called the Big Bang Theory. You could think historically, Copernicus, Galileo, all were devout Catholics, and Catholics were engaged in the hard sciences, including Catholic priests. But little by little, we've retracted in some ways from engaging the hard sciences. And this, I think, was what was fascinating to me about the conference put on at the McGrath Institute. that Catholics, young Catholics, don't see the compatibility between faith and the hard sciences. In fact, Laura Penix, who's a young sociologist from Baylor, presented her research, and the Catholics who are quite practicing tend to believe in the hard sciences and see them as being credible and reliable. Rather, it's much more that young Catholics and people who are in school, whether at high school or university level, really want the Catholic Church to not avoid the hard questions that science poses. They want an engagement with it. They don't want a predetermined answer, if you will, but they want to truly explore the questions. And so the purpose of education is not so much to give the right answer as it is to train the mind to critically ask the right questions. And once exposed to science, new questions emerge.
Your Excellency, first I wanted to thank you for your piece. It's titled Faith and Science Are Not Enemies, and Young People Need to Hear It. That's available at ncregister.com. I wanted to ask you, you're obviously somebody who is very scientifically informed and well-read. You have an interest in these topics. What about your own faith journey as a younger person, reconciling these two, faith and reason, faith and science?
For me, it was easy. My father was a physician. I myself, in high school, was taught by the Oblates of St. Francis de Sales, and they didn't just teach us religion. They taught us chemistry, they taught us physics, they taught us calculus. So for a person of faith to be engaged in math and science was normal. I myself, then undergraduate, was a pre-med biology student, and I remember distinctly my first biology class, my professor happened to be a Catholic. He said, if science is atheistic, scientists need not be. And that always kind of stuck with me because I always retained my faith and always worked to try to reconcile my faith or with the sciences, or the sciences opened up a sense of, especially when it's studying physics and chemistry or the complexity of biological life, it provokes. It makes me ask, who made all these things? Or when you consider the Big Bang Theory, what was there before that Big Bang? It's a metaphysical question. And so for me, then I was always engaged in the hard sciences. Even when I was an undergraduate, I took a class on the history of medicine. And the Catholic Church was also involved in medicine, but we lost a little bit of ground because there was this idea that the church should not shed blood. And so we weren't engaged so much in anatomy and physiology as maybe we could have been for a period of time. Nevertheless, the church also was a center, influenced the culture so much and influenced the way people thought and further the respect for the body and the hard sciences. So I always was engaged with the sciences, even in medicine then when I was in medical school. And I had seen this in my father and the example of my brothers, three or four of my brothers are physicians also, that the issues surrounding human life and its origins and its destiny also are not only scientific questions, but metaphysical questions. And so there are some things that science can tell us, and we can approach the truth that way. But faith illuminates our reason and helps us to see things from a different perspective. Our reason certainly helps us to gain, to grasp the human reality and the reality of the world around us and even the universe. At the same time, science doesn't answer all the questions of human life. There are certain things that are mysterious in life, and faith helps us to understand or to engage the mystery, even if we don't perfectly understand. St. Anselm would say, I believe so that I may understand. And I think that's also, I think, something that has motivated me throughout my own journey until at a certain point in my life, I left medical school to then study theology and to become a priest. After which I got a doctorate in moral theology, and again was engaged in these bioethical questions. It happened that my medical background, my scientific background, would help me to engage these questions. I have my older brother, my brother Ashley, teaches at the Ohio State University, and he is a professor of pediatrics at the medical school, but also has a doctorate in philosophy from Georgetown. And so again, he's another example of a layperson who is engaged in faith and science and their compatibility, but he can give some questions or provoke questions in people, make them think more deeply about some of the questions of the meaning of life. And I think this is something that Catholics need to be engaged with. We can't disengage, otherwise we cede the narrative to people who don't believe in God. There was one anthropologist or archaeologist, really, who gave a presentation there who said he's the only person of faith he knows of in his entire field. So wow. Many, many times, unfortunately, the scientific community and higher-ups in higher education will engage in what is known as scientism, which is a kind of an ideology that says the only thing that you can know is through the scientific method. But most people would say, well, we can know many things through the scientific method. That's true. But I'll tell you what I never found in my math books or my chemistry or physics books. I never found love. I never found friendship. I found friendship and love in the community of believers and the companionship of believers in the church, but also in my classmates who were engaged in the same material. Faith wants to engage and ultimately have an encounter with the mystery of who God is. Jesus has revealed himself as the way and the truth and the life. Science also wants to approach the truth, but the truth that science reveals also reveals to me something about who God is and the mystery of the Godhead. And so I don't see faith and science being incompatible at all.
Yeah, you, in fact, make that point very clearly in your piece, and you make note of the fact that Pope Leo XIV recently reminded us that any idea of a binary, of a conflict between faith and science is a false one. And you have that great quote that was used by the Holy Father as well from G.K. Chesterton, who said, "Take away the supernatural and what remains is the unnatural." But you also make note of the idea of a narrowness of scientism, replacing that with a kind of fideism that treats faith as an alternative to science. Can you talk about that too?
Yeah, so I mean, I think this is also one of the things. If you ask, why should I believe a scientist who's done all his research and he's given the proofs, right? He gives these. I believe that this is true because of the proofs he's offered, because of the witness he's giving through these proofs, right? In a similar way, faith is not unreasonable. Rather, there are proofs, and the proof is sometimes given is in the testimony of the witnesses. Do I trust this person? What this person is telling me? And so I think this sometimes is one of the things that we forget, that in either case you have to trust the witness. And the credibility of the witness. The scientist establishes his credibility on the basis of his particular method, but faith operates through a different method, but not one devoid of reason either. So I think that's an important point to make. Science has its methodology, but again, there are other methods than the scientific method to come to a knowledge of truth. And we can experience also the mystery of the truth of God through beauty, through wonder, through awe. The previous peoples, they gazed up at the stars, and it was provocative to them. Even before the scientific method as such was developed, there were people already exploring some of these questions. We needn't be ideological. And I think that's one of the things that the presence of the Society of Catholic Scientists was important. Stephen Barr is their president, but Karen Oberg of Harvard, who's an astrochemist, she also gave a wonderful presentation on creation and its compatibility with the Genesis story and what they're learning from physics. And so she, both of them, their presence as well as those of the other scientists, also allowed the bishops, who don't necessarily have to be experts in the hard sciences, to know, there are people there, lay people, Catholics, who are dedicated, who are truly professional, who use the scientific method and are of the highest caliber scholars in their fields, but who are also persons of faith. And so that we know that we have resources on which we can rely. And one of the things I think that presentation after presentation, whether it was one on the cosmos or one on evolution, what they're beginning to show is how science is revealing more and more the truth of revelation. And so we need to better understand the hard sciences, because they actually help us to engage people in, this is why our story is true. And I think but to know that there's a resource and that there are Catholics out there willing to support their clergy. So we have to, in some ways, not only be aware of their presence and utilize them, But in my mind, we also need to then engage the sciences in our curriculum, across the curriculum, in our Catholic schools, in our PSR programs, and our campus ministry. We need to also have a change in our pedagogical method. Now, I am very closely associated with communion and liberation. Luigi Giussani famously said, and I quote this in the article, reality has never betrayed me. Mm-hmm. So we have to engage reality. But Giussani proposes a pedagogical method. Young people need a tradition in which they grow up. They need some structure. They need some rules. And we certainly provide that in our Catholic schools and through our Catholic faith. But at a certain point, we all know teenagers, young people begin to ask questions. Mm-hmm. And the purpose of education is not to simply give the right answers, but to train the mind to critically examine problems. A problem isn't a problem in the sense of, oh, it's a conflict, I don't know what I'm going to do, but something to be explored more deeply. Because each one of us in our hearts, we have this longing for the true, the good, and the beautiful. And so we have to ask the questions and that help us, because young people are asking, does this tradition in which I've been raised correspond to my heart's desire for the true, the good, and the beautiful? And the risk is involved, Giussani suggests. Namely, that in the freedom, someone could say it does not, and they could walk away. On the other hand, if they have people who can guide them, who can accompany them in their journey, train them to ask the right questions, help them to explore the mysteries more deeply, then they might appropriate the faith and say, yes, in fact, this tradition corresponds to my longing for what's true, good, and beautiful. And science helps reveal that which is true, good, and beautiful. And so they're more likely to be engaged in the faith, appropriate the faith, and actually practice the faith. And so for me, the Conference on Faith and Science not only exposes the limits of science. So many of the scientists said, we don't have all the answers here. We're only just beginning to explore this question. It exposes the limits of science in terms of the metaphysical questions. Mm-hmm. But it also exposes within Catholicism, the need to look at our pedagogical methods. A couple of years ago at the New York Encounter, I led a panel discussion with Dr. David Steiner, who is the director of the Institute for Higher Education at Johns Hopkins. And Dr. Steiner wrote this book called A Nation of Thought. And basically what we're doing in the United States right now, pedagogically, is teaching basic skills. And ever more technical basic skills, but that's what we're doing. We're not actually training the mind to think by engaging the classics, engaging literature, engaging beauty and the arts and so on. And so we're, in some ways, we're creating another generation of automatons. We need to do better for our young people. And so there's been so much emphasis on STEM education. I'm not saying that science and that approach isn't bad, but there has to be something more. And we see this longing for something more or something different in the reemergence of the desire for classical education as well. So there is the question of faith and science, faith and reason. Mm-hmm. But I'm glad the Committee on Doctrine also invited educators to come, because there's a pedagogical and educative question that needs to also be addressed. And our teachers and our principals need to first be engaged in this. And then they themselves can, at school administrators, can engage the teachers so that we can have some curricular reform as well as pedagogical reform, because what's happening in higher education is simply teachers are trained to teach in a very scientific way, without a deeper appreciation of some of the other mysteries of life.
Mm-hmm. Well, Your Excellency, we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you so much for the gift of your time. And there is a great deal to unpack here and a great deal of work for all of us, but we are certainly beneficiaries of a great tradition in the Church.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. I look forward to being on again, but God bless you and all that you do there at the National Catholic Register.
God bless.
God bless you. Bye-bye.
Well, that's it for Register Radio for this week. Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks again for joining us here on EWTN Radio. Until next week, on behalf of our producer, Michael McCall, and Shannon Mullen, I'm Matthew Bunsen. Please take care, and God bless.